Hi, everybody. I'd like to thank everybody for coming, for Cardozo Cyber Law Society for hosting this event. We're all very proud to have such a distinguished speaker here today. I'd like to introduce Richard Stallman with a quote by Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, someone far more eloquent than myself. Every generation has its philosopher, a writer or an artist who captures the imagination of a time. Sometimes these philosophers are recognized as such. Often, it takes generations before the connection is made real. But recognized or not, a time gets marked by the people who speak its ideals, whether in the whisper of a poem or the blast of a political movement. Our generation has a philosopher. He's not an artist or a professional writer. He's a programmer. The programmer Professor Lessig was talking about is Richard Stallman. Richard Stallman is a programmer. His technical accomplishments are legendary within the geek community. He built the basic technical tools, which now assemble millions of computer programs worldwide. He also wrote the GDB debugger and the Emacs text editor, which has developed a following so strong as to become a religion. But the culmination of his effort, a technical effort, is the GNU Linux operating system. GNU Linux has evolved from a small niche operating system to now running more than 60% of the computers that run the internet worldwide. But Richard Stallman is also an activist. In 1984, Richard Stallman left his prestigious job at MIT to break free from the strict limits on his freedom to create software. It is only after he severed his ties with MIT that he was able to build his most lasting achievement, the legal doctrine of copyleft and the GNU General Public License, or GPL. Today, the GPL has given millions of programmers and engineers around the world the freedom to create, tinker with, and run computer programs in a way that enhance their creativity and productivity. It has leveled the playing field, allowing engineers all around the world to compete on their intellect rather than on their pocketbook. Sorry. For his efforts, Richard Stallman has been awarded 15 honorary doctorates, 2 honorary professorships, and has been canonized in the Church of Emacs. On behalf of the Cardozo Cyber Law Society and the Cardozo School of Law at large, I'd like to give Richard Stallman a very warm welcome.
Well, I don't think it's quite up to 15. And my job at MIT was hardly prestigious, although for many years I enjoyed it very much because I was working on developing free operating system software, and I loved doing it. But I want to point out that the reason that I launched the development of the free software GNU operating system was not because I wanted to level a playing field or because I was concerned about creativity, which is a secondary issue at best. I wanted freedom. Now, this speech is not about free software. This speech is the answer to a question that people sometimes ask me at the end of a speech about free software. So I better say a little about free software as an introduction. Free software means software that respects the user's freedom. Something far more important than creativity or level playing fields or all the things our society encourages people habitually to focus their attention on as a distraction. It's software that respects the user's freedom and respects the social solidarity of the user's community. Non-free software, proprietary software, user subjugating software keeps users divided and helpless. Divided because they're forbidden to share it with anyone, and helpless because they don't have the source code, so they can't change it. They can't even independently verify what it's really doing to them. And often it's been designed to do something nasty that the users may not be able to see. But free software respects the user's freedom. What does that mean? It means that the user has the 4 essential freedoms. Freedom 0 is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom 1 is the freedom to study the source code and then change it to make the program do what you wish. Freedom 2 is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to redistribute exact copies of the program when you wish. And that could mean giving them away or selling them as you wish. And freedom 3 is the freedom to contribute to your community, which is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. With these four freedoms, the social system of the program's distribution and use is an ethical system because it respects the user's freedom and it respects the social solidarity of the community. And the users, both individually and collectively, are in control of the program and in control of their own computing. But if one of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, that means it's proprietary software, non-free software, and it means the developer of the program controls the program and thus controls the users. A non-free program is an instrument of unjust power. This is not a question of what's in the code of the program. It's not directly a question of what the program has been set up to do when it runs. It's directly a question of the social arrangements imposed on users of the program. Either they respect your freedom adequately or they don't. But indirectly, if the program's not free, if the users don't control it, in effect, they're not living in a democracy. And their lord, the developer of the program, is very likely to mistreat them or bully them or exploit them using the program as an instrument. You've got to expect that once somebody has unjust power over you. So, the idea of the free software movement is that software must be free because users deserve these freedoms. If this were a speech about free software, I would explain in detail the reasons for each of these freedoms. Why is it essential? And I would explain the history of developing the GNU operating system and how Linux got added to it in 1992 when it became free and how we got a complete operating system, which is basically GNU, but most people think it's all Linux. But that's not the topic, because at the end of that talk, a person might ask the question, do these ideas extend to anything other than software? Now, the people who ask that are usually being wise guys. So they say, like, what about hardware? Should computers be free? What about chairs, tables, microphones? Well, let's see. Remember, free in this context refers to four specific freedoms. Let's see how they would apply to these physical objects. Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, would become the freedom to use the object as you wish. And in general, you have that freedom. Once you buy the object, you're free to do any lawful thing with it. The manufacturer doesn't impose conditions in a contract on how you're going to use the object after you buy it. So you've got freedom zero. What about freedom one, the freedom to study and then change the source code of the program? Well, here we hit a snag. There's no source code for physical objects in general. We have to adapt it. It could become the freedom to study and change the object. And that freedom you have. The manufacturer doesn't make you sign a contract, and since there's no source code to withhold from you, there's really nothing the manufacturer can do to stop you from changing it, except that the nature of physical objects is changing them is harder, and depending on what the object is, there may be more or fewer feasible possibilities of actually changing it. If you've got a wooden chair, there are a lot of things you could conceivably do to it that you might find useful. A metal chair is harder to change. A plastic chair is pretty hard to change. A computer chip is essentially impossible to change in its physical structure. If you tried to do that, you would just destroy it in the process. No one can do that. So the answer is you've got freedom one, but the possibilities of actually exercising it are limited in practice. What about freedom two, the freedom to copy it and distribute the copies? Well, there, in most cases, it's totally unfeasible to even try because there are no copiers. So it's a meaningless question whether you're allowed to do it. Feasibly, you can't. And likewise, freedom three. Suppose you modify the object, there's still no copiers with which to copy your modified object and distribute copies. So the answer is physical objects usually are as free as in practice they could be. The limits are considerable, but they're not imposed by anybody as an act of imposing his will on you. They're just natural limits on what's possible. So that question is a wise guy question, but there are other things for which this question makes sense and is important, namely other kinds of works made up of information that you might have a copy of, and then you could use your computer to copy them and change them. And because it's feasible to do so, the question of whether you are allowed to do so is a meaningful question and an important one. And that's the question this talk is about. Now, if you have a copy of something that isn't software, then generally the only thing that's likely to deny you the freedom to copy or change it is copyright law. Software is a special case. Copyright can be used to make programs non-free, but it's not the main way of doing so. Contracts are generally used, and just withholding the source code hamstrings the user, denies the user freedoms 1 and 3. But there's nothing like source code for other kinds of works, like text or images. What you see is all there is. So basically, the only thing that would deny you these freedoms is copyright law. So we can ask the same question from the other side by saying, what should copyright law say about these works? Now, as we consider that, it's useful to look at the history of copyright law and the history of copying, because they're linked. Changes in technology can't alter basic moral principles. This seems to be coming and going. Okay. Does it work better now? It still sounds like it's coming and going. Well, yeah, it's true. I studied Bulgarian singing, so probably you could all hear me anyway. But there may be something. Is there anything recording through this microphone? Well, I'll just leave it here and it'll do whatever good it'll do. So, changes in technology can't alter basic moral principles, which are too deep to be touched by them. But when we apply our principles to any particular question, we do it by looking at the choices and what their consequences would be. A change in context can make the same action become more good or more bad by altering its consequences. So, for instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, murder wouldn't be so bad. The judge would say, you killed him, you're going to pay for his new body. And in the US, we would all have to carry uninsured murderer insurance. But in other countries, the National Health Service would pay for it. So, let's look at the history of copying. It began in the ancient world, where it was done with a writing implement on a writing surface. You'd read one copy, and you would write the same thing on another. Now, this technology was very inefficient, but it had other interesting consequences as well. First of all, it had no economy of scale. To make 10 copies would take you 10 times as long as one copy. Second, it required no special equipment other than the equipment for writing. Third, it required no special skill other than the skill of literacy itself. The result was that copies were made in a decentralized way. Wherever someone had one copy and wanted another and was willing to do the work or pay someone to do it, another copy was made. In the ancient world, there was no idea of copyright. If you had a copy of a book and you wanted to copy it, no one would tell you you couldn't, except if the local prince didn't like the book. Then he might tell you you couldn't copy it, which is not copyright, however, but something closely related, namely censorship. So So the ancient world went on for thousands of years, but then there was a tremendous advance in copying technology, the printing press, which made copying much more efficient, but not uniformly so, because the printing press only made sense for mass production. So we got a situation where mass production copying was a lot more efficient, and one-off copying was no more efficient than before, because the best way to do that was by hand. Basically, the thing is, it takes a lot of work to set the type, and once you have set the type, you can quickly make many identical copies. So this is an inherent economy of scale. Also, the printing press and the type were expensive equipment. Most literate people didn't own them, and most didn't know how to use them either, because using the printing press was a different skill from writing or reading. So the result was printing became a specialized industry, and copies of any given book were made in a few places, and then they were transported to the people who wanted to buy them. In the first few centuries of printing, a lot of copies were still made by hand, either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people, because as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. A song that was popular in the 30s and may be popular again next year. So there were poor people who couldn't afford printed copies, but they had time on their hands to write a copy for themselves. Now, copyright began in the age of the printing press, around 1500, I believe. I've read that in Italy, it was the thing that if you wrote a book, you could ask a prince to give you a monopoly on printing it. And if a prince liked you, he would give you the monopoly. Princes used to reward people with monopolies over any whatever thing back then. But it became customary to give these monopolies to authors. Copyright in England began as a system of censorship. Censorship of Protestants, I believe, at first. To print a book, you had to ask the government for permission, and the permission was given as a perpetual monopoly to one publisher. The censorship system became obsolete in the 1600s, and at that point, people started to rethink the system, and in the early 1700s, copyright was changed into a temporary monopoly given to the author, I believe, for 14 years. Does anyone know for certain if that's right? In any case, the idea developed that copyright was a scheme to encourage writing. When the U.S. Constitution was written, there was a proposal that authors be entitled to a copyright. You'd never believe it to hear what the publishers say, but this proposal was rejected. And instead, the U.S. Constitution says, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the exclusive use of their respective writings and discoveries. Now, this gives 3 points. First of all, it doesn't require a copyright system. It merely permits one optionally. Congress shall have the power, not Congress shall. Second, the purpose of copyright is not benefit for copyright holders. It's to promote progress, which is a benefit for the general public, something the publishers try very hard to erase from our minds. And third, copyright must last for a limited time, which the publishers have found another way to erase. So, in the age of the printing press, copyright functioned as an industrial regulation because it didn't forbid anything that ordinary readers could do. If you were restricted by copyright, it's because you were either a publisher or an author. In in the 1800s, lots of poor people kept copying books by hand, but nobody thought of trying to forbid them based on copyright law. I think the first US copyright law didn't even apply to that. However, printing presses got a lot more efficient in the late 1800s, and printed copies got a lot cheaper, and even poor people could buy them. So that's when paperback books got started. It made sense at that point to try to economize on the binding. So eventually people forgot that it had been common for people to copy books by hand. But still, it ended up operating as an industrial regulation on publishers, controlled by the authors, and set up to provide benefits to the general public. Therefore, it was easy to enforce, generally uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial for the public. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers, and it's easy to find out who's publishing a book. You go to a bookstore and say, who made those copies? You don't have to invade everybody's home and everybody's computer to do that. It was uncontroversial because the readers were not being restricted, so they had nothing to complain about. And it was arguably beneficial because in this so-called copyright bargain, meaning copyright deal, the public traded away part of its natural right to copy anything, and in exchange received the benefits of more writing, more books you could read, more conversation about important issues that might conceivably help society make up its mind about something. So if we were still in the age of the printing press, I don't think I would be criticizing copyright law. However, the age of the printing press is gradually giving way to the age of the computer networks, another advance in copying technology, which again makes copying more efficient, and again, non-uniformly, because here was a situation in the age of the printing press, mass production copying a lot more efficient than one-off copying, which was still as slow as it had been in the ancient world. Digital information technology gives us this, where one-off copying is almost as convenient and efficient as mass production copying. Not quite, not exactly as efficient, but almost. And efficient enough that hundreds of millions of people can do it, and do it. The result is that even if the word of copyright law had not changed from 50 years ago, the effect would be totally different, because now it's a restriction on every citizen. It's no longer functioning as an industrial regulation. Now it's a restriction on every citizen controlled by the publishers, giving lip service, typically, to the authors. And thus, no longer easy to enforce, no longer uncontroversial, and no longer beneficial. It's no longer easy to enforce because now it has to be enforced against each and every one of us, and the war on sharing requires cruel and draconian laws. It's now controversial because citizens don't like being stopped from sharing, and they complain. And it's no longer beneficial because, you see, this trade was beneficial because we traded away freedoms that we were nominally entitled to but that we couldn't exercise anyway. We lost nothing. If you have something you can't use and you trade it for something of some value to you, it's a positive deal. Whether it's the best possible deal, that's a secondary question, but it's a positive deal. But now it's no longer positive because we can use those freedoms and we want to use them. So, a government sincerely trying to represent its citizens and defend their rights would say, I'm sorry, this deal, this trade of our citizens' freedom must be ended because the freedoms that we thought we could give up on our citizens' behalf back then in the age of the printing press, now they need, and we must reduce this deal. not necessarily eliminate it entirely, but at least reduce it so that the citizens once again have the freedoms they find necessary. We can measure the lack of democracy around the world by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite. They are extending copyright in every possible dimension. For instance, the dimension of time. In the US, copyright has been extended over and over in recent decades. The last time was in 1998, when copyright was extended by 20 years for both past and future works, supposedly to provide more incentive to make new works. Now, how extension of copyright on the works of the 1920s and 30s could, in 1998, could lead to more production of works back then, I cannot imagine. If they have a time machine, apparently they didn't use it, because our history books don't record that everyone in the arts set to work with a fresh enthusiasm when they learned that in 1998 their copyrights would be extended. Why didn't they tell them? Now, extending copyright by 20 more years on future works could conceivably provide more motivation to write those works, but not to anybody rational, because copyright already lasted so long. It was 75 years for a work made by a company's employees. That the discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright that far in the future is so small that it wouldn't be a factor in any business decision today. So we know what was really going on. There were various companies that enjoyed lucrative monopolies that were scheduled to come to an end. Companies like Disney, which realized that the copyright on the first film where Mickey Mouse appeared was going to expire in a few years, and then anybody would be allowed to draw Mickey Mouse inside of other works. And Disney has obtained a lot from the public domain but doesn't want anything to go back. Therefore, Disney paid for a law to extend the copyright on Mickey Mouse. I'm sure lots of other companies similarly paid to extend other lucrative monopolies that they already had, and thus the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act was passed. That's what we generally call it. So the movie companies say they want perpetual copyright, but they haven't got enough power, not quite, to pass a constitutional amendment. So they can't explicitly get perpetual copyright. And therefore, they worked out a scheme to indirectly get the same results, which somebody referred to as perpetual copyright on the installment plan, where every 20 years, they're going to extend the copyright 20 years more. So the result is, if you look at any given work, there is theoretically some date when it will go into the public domain. But don't hold your breath, because that date is like tomorrow. It never comes. By the time you reach that date, they will have postponed it forever. That's their plan. So I suppose in 2018, they're going to try to pass another such extension, unless we stop them. But time is only one of the dimensions affecting copyright power. The other is the breadth of the power. Which activities does copyright control? You see, in the age of the printing press, copyright was not intended to control all uses of a copyrighted work. There were certain uses that were covered by copyright, and everything else people were simply free to do. But the publishers imagine that digital technology will give them and enables them to seize total control of all uses of published works and set up a pay-per-view universe where anything you try to do with a copyrighted work will require their permission. And their way of trying to do this is with DRM, Digital Restrictions Management. the intentionally implemented malicious feature of refusing to do what you tell the program to do. So the first place people saw this generally was in DVDs. DVDs usually have a video that is encrypted. And the reason for the encryption was to restrict you. The idea, this was set up by a group of companies that set up a conspiracy to restrict the public's access to technology, to control what technology would or wouldn't do. And this conspiracy said, anybody that wants to make a DVD player will have to join the conspiracy and agree to build their DVD players to restrict the public just like all the other DVD players. That's why they all restrict people the same. That's why there's essentially no visible progress in DVD players since they first came out. Because the conspiracy controls how they're made. So these products are designed to attack your freedom. And you must never accept products designed to attack your freedom. So you should never, that is, unless you have the means to break the digital handcuffs. So you must never buy or rent a DVD or with an encrypted video or accept one as a gift unless you possess the free program capable of decrypting the video and escaping from the restrictions they try to place on you. Now, that format, there was never supposed to be any free software to do this. That format was meant to be secret, but people figured it out, and they released a free program that can decrypt the video on a DVD. So in 1998, they purchased a law to forbid the distribution of that free software. The U.S. practices censorship of software. So, this shows again, the government's on the wrong side. You see, a conspiracy to restrict the public's access to technology ought to be a felony. The executives of those companies should be in prison. But they know that the government is on their side against us. They are so confident of this that they don't even bother to keep the conspiracy a secret, which is how I know about it. Anyone can find out about it. They're happy to tell you how they conspire to attack your freedom. They are sure we will never get the government to defend us. But in fact, the movie companies know that they can't suppress the availability of that free software, even though it's illegal to distribute. So they developed another scheme for digital restrictions management, which they call AACS. I once looked at the website of the AACS conspiracy, which had a file describing their rules that they demanded everybody follow. And it said, for instance, that after 2011, the manufacturers will not be allowed to make analog video outputs. You see, they want to close what they call the analog hole. I can show you a couple of these analog holes that they want to plug. You might have some also. And they assumed that AACS would never be broken. Then 2 years ago, somebody released a free program that could decrypt the AACS encryption. But that was useless because without the key, you couldn't actually decrypt anything. And then, 6 months later, I saw a photo of two adorable puppies, almost as adorable as these little gnus. And above them were 32 hex digits. And I wondered, why did anyone put those together? I wonder if those numbers are a key that the empire is going to try to erase all knowledge of. And by putting them on top of those puppies, they made sure people would copy it because they liked the puppies. And thus the number would not get lost. And indeed, that's what it was. That was the key to break the axe. Unfortunately, that didn't win the battle. You see, they changed the key. And meanwhile, that was enough to break the DRM on HD DVD. But Blu-ray has another level of digital restrictions management, and so far there is no free software that can break that. I hope there will be, but who knows? In any case, if you don't have the means to break the DRM in Blu-ray discs, you must not surrender your freedom to them. But video is not the only medium where we have seen digital restrictions management. It's also been in music a lot. About a decade ago, we started to see things that looked like compact discs, but they were not made following the specifications of compact discs, so we call them corrupt discs. They were designed so that you couldn't read the music into a computer. I once gave a speech like this in Spain, and my hosts were a regional government agency, so they gave me afterwards books and records of music about the region. And one of the records I wanted to listen to, but fortunately before I opened it, I saw that instead of the compact disc logo, it said copy control. See, in a number of European countries, these corrupt discs can't be labeled with the compact disc logo. So anyway, I didn't open it, I gave it back, and I said, here you see the face of the enemy. Please give it back to the store. They should not keep your money. Well, I couldn't listen to it, but that's okay. I won't give up my freedom to a corrupt disc. Sony got into hot water a few years ago for its scheme for corrupt discs. They had a very clever scheme. The idea was that if you put the disc into a computer, the disc would install some software into the computer. And this software is called a rootkit, meaning it's like software used in a virus or used by a cracker to take control of the machine. So this software would take control of the system and install itself inside the system. Now, this is a felony, but they did it anyway. And furthermore, it modified certain commands, for instance, commands that you would use to investigate what's in the system so that it wouldn't see this software. It would pretend this software wasn't there. And also other commands you might use to delete these files wouldn't work. They wouldn't delete it. And if this isn't bad enough, they committed another felony. You see, this software also contained code that had been released under the GNU GPL, which says, first of all, that any larger program containing some of that code can only be released under the GNU GPL, and they have to provide the source code on request, and they have to give the user a copy of the GNU GPL so the user knows her rights. And Sony didn't do any of that, which is commercial copyright infringement. Of course, Sony was never prosecuted because our government understood that all these laws are meant to protect companies from us, not protect us from companies. But people did sue Sony. However, they focused their criticism on side issues, not on the fundamentally evil thing that Sony was trying to do to them. So Sony settled the suit. Sony promised that in the future, when it sets out to attack our freedom to use our copies of published works, it would not do the other secondary nasty things. And Sony has learned its lesson. In the future, the rootkit will be installed in the computer before you get it, and it will be impossible to remove, which is already the case in the PlayStation 3. No one has found a way to get rid of the DRM in the PlayStation 3. So you shouldn't, under any circumstances, get one or recommend that anybody get one. Now, DRM in music is sort of going away for the most part. The companies just saw that they weren't gaining much from it. They were making lots of people hate them, which is good. They need to see that a lot of people are going to hate them. Ah, what a nice shirt. If you could come up and turn around. We'll have to set up a catwalk. So we've mostly seen DRM on music go away, but we are seeing renewed attempts to impose DRM on books. You see, the publishers of books would like to take away traditional freedoms of readers to do things like borrow a book from the public library, or lend a book to your friend, to buy a book anonymously by paying cash, or sell it to a used bookstore, and even the freedom to keep the book as long as you like and read it as many times as you like, and maybe pass it on to your children who might themselves read it and pass it on. All these freedoms they want to take away from us. But democracy, even though it's very sick, is not quite dead, and there are millions of people who read books who would get angry if that were proposed. So instead of trying to directly take away these freedoms, they came up with a two-stage plan to achieve the same result. Stage one was to take away these freedoms for ebooks. And they did that with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998, meeting very little opposition because there were no ebooks and nobody reading ebooks, so except for a few of us who saw what this was going to lead to, people didn't pay attention. The second stage was to convince people to stop reading paper books and read ebooks instead. And that they did it in the early years of this decade. And there was a worldwide coordinated, funded PR campaign to convince people to use ebooks. One publisher thought it could get its line of ebooks started with a bang with a biography of me. Yeah, my life keeps on presenting me with opportunities to betray my message in order to get the message out. So if I just become a total hypocrite, a lot of people will hear what I say. So they found a writer and sent him to me, and he asked for my cooperation. I said, I'll cooperate if this ebook is published without encryption, without DRM. The publisher didn't accept that, so I suggested to him another publisher who did accept it. In fact, the book was written and published. It's free, as in freedom. It gives you the four freedoms. It's published under the GNU Free Documentation License, which I originally wrote for manuals for free software. In any case, they started publishing ebooks, but they flopped. People just didn't read them. They didn't accept ebooks. And I said, well, that was a relief, but they're going to try again. And then for many years, we used to see lots of articles, a surprising number of articles about, I think they called it electronic paper, which is basically another kind of display screen for an ebook. And I said, they're going to try again because, you know, companies that want to take away our freedom, if they fail, their staff are paid to keep trying. They'll try over and over. And now they are trying again with products like the Sony Shredder. Well, they call it the Reader, but if you tack on SH, it gives you a much more accurate description of the effects. And the Amazon Swindle. You see, they don't want, they hope people will buy it without realizing what they're really buying and what it implies. Imagine going to visit a friend and there are no books. You would have expected to see some bookshelves with interesting books there, but there are none. And it's not that your friend doesn't read, it's that your friend's books are all in a little device. And it wouldn't be reasonable even to try to browse through them, let alone ask him to lend you his whole library at once. So goodbye to an important part of friendship. Spread the word. Make sure people know just what it is they are selling. Then they won't buy it. So we see over and over again the threat of digital restrictions management. We need, and it's almost always set up by a conspiracy of companies. All of these examples actually do involve, I believe, a conspiracy of companies, except maybe Sony's. Maybe Sony was the only company involved there. So we need an organized response. And that organized response is the Defective by Design campaign set up by the Free Software Foundation. Go visit defectivebydesign.org and you can sign up to be notified about our protests. And please participate in the protests. We need lots of participation because the mission is to show mega corporations that if they try to attack our freedom with their products, they will be hated and they will not gain. So this is what the mega corporations and their tame governments have been doing to our freedom through copyright law. But what would a government do if it wanted to represent its citizens? Well, it would reduce copyright power. But how? Here are my suggestions. First, there's the dimension of time. We need to make copyright a lot shorter. And I propose 10 years starting from the date of publication. Now, why 10 years? Why from the date of publication? Because before the work is published, we don't have copies. So the question of whether we would be allowed to copy them if we had them is a moot point. And then why 10 years? Well, in the US, the typical publication cycle is under 3 years. Almost all books are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within three. 10 years is more than three times that long, so I think it should be comfortable. But not everyone agrees with that. I once proposed these same things on a panel discussion with fiction writers, and the award-winning fantasy writer sitting next to me said, 10 years? Absolutely not. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. I was surprised too. You see, when the publishers demand increased power over us, they always say that they're doing this in the name of the semi-divine, quote, creators, unquote, meaning the authors. And I naively believed that this was serious. I didn't know until I started to, things like this started to show me, that these same companies are constantly grinding those authors into the ground with their heels. For instance, this author had a dispute with his publisher. His book contract said that if the book went out of print, the rights would revert to him. But as far as he could tell, his book was out of print. However, the publisher refused to admit it and was using the copyright on his book to stop him from distributing copies of his own book, which he wanted to do so that people could read it. Now, this is an interesting thing. He wanted people to be able to read his work. This is what every author starts out wanting. And most of them continue wanting this. There are a few exceptions who get corrupted by a lot of money, like J.K. Rowling. And they start wanting money more than anything else. But most writers don't even have the don't ever get enough money to corrupt them. So they continue wanting, above all, for people to appreciate their work. He knew that more than 5 years of copyright was much more likely to cause him harm than do him good. So he said 5 years, no more. Well, I'm not necessarily against that. When I say 10 years, I'm not saying 10 years is exactly right. I'm saying it's a rough estimate. Let's try changing it to 10 years and then see the results. We might decide to shorten it to 5 years if that's what people want. I won't argue against it. But I'm being a little bit more cautious when I propose 10. Well, that's one dimension, but what about the other dimension of breadth, which activities copyright should control? I don't think it should be the same for all works. I distinguish three broad categories of works and suggest different treatment for them. First of all, there are the works that you use to do a practical job in your life. These are functional works. Then there are the works whose contribution to society is they tell you what certain people thought. And then there are the works of art and entertainment whose contribution to society is in the impact of the work. Three different ways a work can make a contribution to society, which I believe lead to three different conclusions. First, let's look at the works of practical use that you use to do a job. These include software, recipes for cooking, educational works, reference works, text fonts, and various other things I'm sure you can think of. These works must be free, because if you use the work to do a practical job in your life, then if you don't control the work, you don't control your life. And freedom is having control of your own life. So you've got to be free to change the work to do the job you want to do. And once you've done that, you should be free to publish your version in case there are other people who want to do the same job you wanted to do. But it's absurd to try to restrict redistribution of exact copies while permitting distribution of modified versions. That just forces people to go to the trouble of making a change that, practically speaking, doesn't really alter anything. It's silly. So we've got to permit the four freedoms. Someone might respond, but if we don't let the authors of the works take away our freedom and control us, they won't write any, and then we'll be in desperate trouble. So join me, let's surrender our freedom. Well, 20 years ago, we couldn't prove they were wrong. We could only hope they were wrong. But today, there's a lot of empirical evidence that they're wrong. For instance, there's the free software community with many thousands of useful free software packages. And then there are all the recipes that circulate basically as if they were free. And in the reference works area, we can look at great free references such as Wikipedia. Education is a place where we've been slower to get going, but we are. You can look at freetextbookproject.org and see that people are now starting to publish free educational works. So what we see is there's no need to panic and despair and surrender our freedom. We can hold out for freedom and works will still be written. Besides, there are lots of ways we can artificially encourage the writing of works that will respect our freedom, supposing we think artificial encouragement is called for, and it may be. There are many other ways to do that. So, in the first category, my conclusion is these works must be free, which in the case of software is not the same as simply not letting them be copyrighted. Because remember, there are other ways to make a program non-free, and we'd have to block those also. What about the second category, the works whose contribution to society is to tell you what certain people thought? These include memoirs and autobiographies. They include essays of opinion. They include scientific papers. Because the most important thing in a scientific paper is generally the author's name. So the authors say, we did this, and this is what we saw. Our reputation is on the line. If you didn't know whose reputation is on the line, it wouldn't do much good. So, to publish a modified version of these works is to misrepresent the authors, and that's not particularly socially useful. So there's no particular reason why people should be free to publish modified versions of these works. That makes it possible to recommend a reduced copyright system in which everyone is free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies of the work, but all modification and all commercial use is covered by copyright as now. So we just make a small reduction in today's copyright power, which gives people freedom zero, the freedom to use their copies, and part of freedom two, because it's only non-commercial redistribution of exact copies, which I'm advocating. Now, this freedom to non-commercially share is crucial, because this is what ends the war on sharing. These cruel laws, the cruel practices of suing teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the proposals have got even nastier than that. In the UK, there was an MP proposed a law for 10 years imprisonment for sharing. Basically, what we see is these companies that profit by not letting people share are prepared to go to any lengths to maintain their power, but they don't deserve that power. So, by allowing non-commercial sharing, we effectively turn copyright back into the industrial regulation that it was in the age of the printing press. We get rid of the difficulty in enforcing it and the part that is intolerable to the readers and listeners, and it may once again be beneficial. And this reduced copyright system will continue to offer a revenue stream to the writers and artists in more or less the same lousy, inadequate way as it does today. But what about the third category, works of art and entertainment? In this category, for years, I was in a quandary about modified versions. Because on the one hand, there's the argument that a work of art can have an artistic integrity, and modifying it can destroy that integrity. And I think that is sometimes true, even if not as often as the artists like to claim. Just look at how most of them will let Hollywood butcher their work completely in exchange for enough money. That's not artistic integrity. But on the other hand, there are a few who insist that Hollywood respect the works, and maybe they do have artistic integrity. On the other hand, look at the value of modifying artistic works as contribution to art. And consider, for instance, the Falk process, where a series of people can modify a work and produce something rich. On the other hand, if we want to consider named authors only, consider, for instance, Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's works used stories taken from other works that had been published a few decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect, then those plays would have been illegal, and presumably they wouldn't have been written, and we'd never have seen them. And the copyright holders would have said, supposing Shakespeare had complained, or whoever really wrote those plays, the copyright holders would have responded, Shakespeare just wants to make a cheap ripoff of my work. And there's that would be no value to society. There's no reason why he should be allowed to do that. And if we had never seen these plays, we would have had no basis to disbelieve them. But since we have seen them, we say that they're important literature. And if we want to consider, and it's important to remember that every time they say these modified things would just be cheap ripoffs, there's no reason to allow them, keep in mind that if they're not allowed, you can't judge that claim. If we want to look at more recent works, well, there's we have here the author of Sita Sings the Blues, which has run into a similar kind of problem, and I thought it was pretty good. So,
anyone here heard of it?
So we have this problem. Modified versions of works of art can violate artistic integrity, but they can be contributions to art. What should we do about that? Well, it eventually occurred to me that modifying artistic works can be a contribution to art, but it's not desperately urgent. If you're using a work to do a practical job in your life, you must be free to change it today. If you'd like to modify an artistic work to make another contribution to art, it would be no disaster if you had to wait 10 years for the copyright to expire. After all, when the work goes in the public domain, people are free to make modifications, which the original artist might have thought would violate the integrity, but it's allowed anyway. Well, for 10 years, we can have the reduced copyright system, where everybody's free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies of the work, but modification and commercial use are covered by copyright. And this would provide a revenue stream to the artist in more or less the same usually lousy, inadequate way as today. And then the copyright would expire and everyone would be free to publish their modified versions, and thus make further contributions to art. So as long as copyright doesn't last too long, that's acceptable. So those are my recommendations. Now, of course, there's also the phenomenon of remix. A lot of people take little snippets of things and put them together. And if the idea of copyright is to encourage making works, remix is simply something that should be legal. So if it isn't fair use, it ought to be fair use. Because we must not forget, when we consider the questions of what copyright should cover, what the purpose is supposed to be. And it's not giving the maximum power to copyright holders, it's providing the benefit of promoting progress to society as a whole. Now, this minimum freedom to non-commercially share exact copies is the minimum freedom that we must have for any published work. And it implies, in particular, that file sharing on the net should be legal. Sharing is good, and to attack sharing is evil. Sharing creates the bonds of society. To attack sharing is to attack society. Now, the record companies like to claim that if you share music, you are taking the money out of the artist's pockets. This, you may have heard the statement that a half-truth is worse than a lie. Well, this is more like a few percent truth. You see, there are a few records in the record store for which it's true that the musicians would get some money if you bought them. And for just about all the records in the record store, what the musicians will get is zero. I normally get music by buying commercial CDs, and I'm always ashamed to realize I'm not supporting the musicians. you might wonder why they get zero. Isn't there a part of the purchase price which is for the musicians? Well, nominally, yes. But the production and publicity expenses are considered an advance to the musicians by the accountants, which means that that share which is for the musicians, that share of your purchase price, goes from one account in the record company to another, and that's where it stays. It is extremely rare for any record to sell so many copies that it fully repays this so-called advance and starts actually sending money to the musicians when you buy the record. A record can go platinum, according to what I've read, and not reach that point, given the actual practices that record companies have followed. Now, this is not to say that musicians get no benefit from having a record contract. They get the benefit of the publicity, so they have more concerts, more people come to their concerts, and that's how they actually make money. Now, this applies to nearly all musicians, but there are a few exceptions, and those are the long-established stars. You see, the first record contract normally covers 5 or 7 albums. Once the band has released that many, and it finishes its first contract, if it is famous, then it has clout and it can negotiate another contract which doesn't exploit it. And that will apply to the band's subsequent albums. Of course, not the old ones, those remain under the old contract. So if you buy the recent albums of a famous band that's existed for a long time, then you're actually supporting the musicians. Now, so the others, they get the benefit of the publicity through their concerts. But there are other ways. Oh, and by the way, watch out. The record companies are now getting their hooks into the concerts as well. So most of the money from that goes to the record company too. And they get their hooks into the fan material. It's really hard to support those musicians. So there are other ways to give publicity to music. For instance, if one person mails a copy of a nice song to another person and says, listen to this, that is publicity, and it's healthier publicity because it's not controlled by money. It's healthier for music too. And as for the major record companies that have lobbied for laws to attack our freedom and that sue college students for hundreds of thousands of dollars, this will help give them what they deserve, which is to disappear. Now, I don't see anything wrong with the business of making records and selling them as long as people want to buy some. And if we had laws that required these companies to actually pay the musicians, it might be a good thing. But those companies that have intentionally attacked our freedom, for that, they deserve to fail completely and disappear. Now, because of this, I think it's clear that music sharing will not be a disaster for music. I think it will be good for music. What about movies? We have all heard the tremendous figures cited as the cost of making movies. How could they possibly continue doing so? Well, those costs you hear are inflated twice. According to a producer I met, more than half is actually publicity rather than making the movie. And second, even that part has been inflated by creative accounting. You see, the studio wants to keep more of the income for itself and give less to its investors or to the U.S. Treasury, so they find ways to inflate the costs, which they can recoup first. Then you put this together with the fact that a lot of use of movies is commercial use and thus would be covered by my proposed reduced copyright system, just as today. So I think that they would be able to make the actual costs of making movies. And it may not be true anymore, but we used to be told that the special effects were tremendously expensive. Well, surely in 20 years they won't be expensive. And in the meantime, if they waited for a while and focused on stories about people instead of special effects, I don't think that would be the end of the world. And ultimately, we have to recognize that what Hollywood makes is almost always crap. And not because somebody was stupid. It's not because they always make mistakes. It's because of the system. I read a book once called Save the Cat, which purports to give advice on how to write screenplays and sell them. I wasn't interested in doing that. I was just curious. Because for me, what that book told me was how the system operates to ensure that what Hollywood makes is crap. Now, if people want to make art that's crap, they have a right to do so. I'm not in favor of censorship on the grounds that something is crap. But that's not the question. Whether to censor them, whether to stop them is not the question. The question is whether we ought to give up freedom we want in order to help them keep making crap. And I see no need to do that. Now, so I think that just legalizing sharing would be no disaster at all. But we might want to support the arts better than the existing lousy system. I have two suggestions for how. One way is using taxes. We could conceivably tax blank CDs or internet connectivity, or we could use general revenue, whatever. We could use this to make a fund to support some of the arts. And we could distribute this money only to artists, not to corporations, but to the people who participated in the creative activities. And we could do it not based on grant applications, but based on their popularity and success as determined by sampling, for instance, polling. And thus, no bureaucrats making arbitrary decisions. It's all based on what they've earned in some sense. But, and this is a crucial point, I propose not to distribute it in linear proportion to their success. Because if, you know, a star can be 1,000 times as popular as another capable and fairly successful artist. And if we distribute in linear proportion, the star would get 1,000 times as much, which means either we need to pay out lots of money making the stars really rich in order to give enough to lots of good, fairly successful artists, or else the amount we give to them won't be enough to support them. So, suppose we use a function that tapers off. Consider, for instance, cube root. If star A is 1,000 times as successful as capable artist B, then the cube root function would give A 10 times as much money as B instead of 1,000 times as much. So the stars would, each individual star would still get more, considerably more, but most of the money wouldn't go to a few stars. Most of it would go to support adequately a large number of good artists. And thus, the system's efficiency for doing its intended job, which is to support the arts, would be far greater, like 100 times greater. Of course, these numbers are not real. I don't know what they would actually be, but you see the general point. On the other hand, some people don't like taxes. I'm not one of them. I'm a liberal. I believe in a welfare state. I believe that taxes should support lots of important things for the state to do. But I can propose another method to support artists through voluntary payments. Suppose each player each for music or video, or each reader for no DRM ebooks or whatever it would be, had a button with a dollar sign. And you could push that button and it would send a dollar to the artists. Or you could decide not to push it. Nothing's gonna pressure you to push it, make you push it. It's up to you. But if you like something, you'll push it. Because it's just a dollar. The loss of a dollar here is not enough of a loss to discourage any of us from sending that money. In fact, why don't you do it now? The reason is it's too inconvenient. The trouble you'd have to go to give that dollar to the artists is so much that unless you were really determined, you wouldn't. So I'm saying, let's get rid of the trouble. Let's make it as easy as pushing a button, say on the remote control or whatever. You could send a dollar. If we make it so easy, a lot of people will do it. Of course, not everyone. There are poor people who really can't afford to send a dollar, and they won't. And that's okay. We don't need to squeeze money out of poor people. There are enough non-poor people who will gladly support the arts. In fact, we can see voluntary payments are already starting to work. During the past year, two famous musical groups, Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails, released albums effectively saying, go ahead and share it and pay if you want. And they got hundreds of thousands of dollars. One of them, I think, got more than $1 million, including the gear that they sold. Well, that's doing pretty well. And it also works for artists that are not famous. There is a Canadian singer who was named Jane Siberry. And I read that she sells downloads of her musical recordings on her website and says to people, pay whatever amount you wish, which could be zero. And on the average, they pay more than a dollar per download. This is interesting because the major record companies charge just under a dollar per download. So by letting people pay or not, on the average, they pay her more. Now, I don't know how much of a living she's making, but clearly more than if she were selling it through one of those record companies and supposedly forcing them to pay. Now, I read about this, but I had never heard of her. Has any of you heard of that singer?
No.
Okay, so do you know why she changed her name to Issa? Do you know why?
No.
Does anyone know? I wonder if it's a copyright dispute of some kind. You know, remember the artist formerly known as Prince? Well, that sounded silly, but I think it was a dispute with his record company to let him to do that. It's not silly after all. So I'd like to find out whether she changed her name for a reason that has to do with this issue. In any case, in February I gave speeches in Canada, and someone there more people had heard of her, and someone gave me one of her records. So I finally got a chance to hear some of that music. The point is, she's not tremendously famous, and yet it still works for her. But it will work better if we make it painless to pay. And that's why I suggest putting this button on the players. And if we think people are not sending a dollar often enough, then we could have a warm and friendly PR campaign. Did you push the button and send a dollar to some artists this week? Why not? Didn't you? You loved what you watched or listened to, and it's only a dollar. Come on, push the button. And people would do it because they'd feel good. Contrast that with the vicious and cruel PR campaigns that we have now, which say that if you share, then you're a thief. If you help your neighbor, that's as bad as attacking ships.